Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Saturday, July 2nd, 2016. This is episode 1301. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TechGuy. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of super tank all-in-one printers, you could print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit Texture.com/TechGuy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones and smartwatches, virtual reality, autonomous vehicles, and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO is my number. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, if you're listening on the internet, you can call us still. Just use Skype or some other VoIP solution and call that number. Because it's toll-free in the U.S., shouldn't cost you anything to use with a VoIP solution anywhere in the world. That's kind of cool. We live in amazing times. A time where cars drive themselves and sometimes into a truck. I think, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first reported fatality in an autonomous vehicle. And, of course, very sad. And I don't know. I think the LA Times had a story today revealing more. I am working off the blog posting from Tesla because it was a Tesla Model S. As you know, Tesla is the first car company to put true autonomy into its cars, the ability to drive themselves. Many cars today have some autonomous features. Maybe you have a Ford or a Volvo with Bliss, the blind spot detection, which will let you know if somebody's in your blind spot. And it does all sorts of interesting. It won't actually take over the car, but it'll shutter the wheel. It'll pre-tension the seat belts. It'll get the brakes ready. You know, it's a kind of a robotic chill goes up its spine as you're about to pull into the next lane with a car there. And that is, the theory is enough to warn you to, cars also have adaptive cruise control, which is actually a great thing, especially if you drive a lot, stop and go traffic. Most cruise control, you set it, and then it's up to you to notice if you're going too fast and you're coming up on a car and hit the brake and turn the cruise control off. Adaptive cruise control sees the car ahead of you, maintains a correct stopping distance, and will slow down and speed up as needed. And in fact, in stop and go traffic, it'll actually stop you, and then it's up to you to restart it. But it will stop you if the traffic in front of you stops. My car has that. It's not unusual. But Teslas go one step further. They actually will change lanes automatically without your intervention at all. They will follow a route in navigation. They, of course, have the adaptive cruise control. Teslas have, they don't have a lot of cameras, but they have some radar in the bumpers, I believe, and a camera, of course, in front. They're able to calculate what's going on around them. And, of course, Tesla is very clear. First of all, it's opt-in. It's disabled, the autopilot. You have to order it in the first place, and then you have to turn it on. They say it's still in a public beta. And, in fact, you have to agree, among other things, that the autopilot is, quote, an assist feature that requires you to keep your hands on the steering wheel at all times. And you need to maintain control and responsibility for your vehicle. That sounds like, I think anybody reading that says, yeah, that's legalese. That's because you don't want to be responsible. it doesn't come across as like, we don't really trust this, and neither should you. But really, maybe that's the new wording we should consider. Always keep your hands on the wheel. Be prepared to take over at any time, the car says. It also says, if your hands aren't physically on the wheel, it can tell, and it will provide you with an alert, and then gradually slows down until you take the wheel. However, we've seen video of people in traffic sleeping in the Tesla. I think after you use it for a little while, and I don't have any direct experience with it, and if you do, I'd love to hear from you. I have friends who have. And I have watched videos of people using it. I think that if you get really comfortable with it, you might be tempted to just kind of set it and forget it. And very sadly, that's what happened. It was on a highway, a fatal crash. According to Tesla, the vehicle was on a divided highway with autopilot engaged. A tractor trailer drove across the freeway perpendicular to the oncoming traffic. And this is what Tesla says. Neither autopilot nor the driver noticed the white side of the tractor trailer against a brightly lit sky. The brake was not applied, either by the autopilot. So the autopilot failed, did not see the oncoming truck, nor did the driver, apparently, trusting the autopilot, or maybe not paying attention, and it plowed into the truck, and the driver was killed. Very, very tragic, of course. And I think it's interesting. We'll watch with interest. Of course, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says we're investigating. We want to know what happened. This is the first known fatality for a Tesla with autopilot engaged over 130 million miles. Tesla's quickly points out that in regular driving, every 94 million miles, there's a fatality in the U.S. Globally, every 60 million miles. So going 130 million miles without a fatality is better. And this is the discussion that's going to happen, which is humans are terrible drivers. But autopilot is not perfect. It's a better driver than you are, but it's not perfect, and bad things will happen. And crashes will happen. And, of course, as soon as a crash happens, people say, wait a minute, they're not perfect? And Tesla says, well, no, but they're better than you are. I don't know if that's – is that satisfying? See, because we all think we are good drivers. See, we don't think we would make a mistake. Nobody thinks, oh, it's better than I am. People think, oh, autopilots are better than the other guy. Of course, those other guys are terrible drivers. But better than me? No, I'm an excellent driver. I've never heard anybody not say, I'm an excellent driver. However horrible they are, however much time they spend texting, putting on makeup, brushing their teeth, reading the paper, and you see all of that on the freeway if you spend any time commuting. I used to take a bus to San Francisco, commute bus to San Francisco, so you're high up and you can see into people's cars and you'd be amazed. You'd be... it was fascinating to look out the window and go, my God, these people are not, they're not paying any attention. So, yes, absolutely. The autopilot's going to be better than you are. Than the other guy. It's not going to be better than you because you're a perfect, you're an excellent driver. Do you think, I'm really curious what you think. Is this enough to slow down the advent of autonomous vehicles? Up until this point, most people go, oh, this is great. You know, we had a national epidemic of distracted driving, 6,000 people a year died while texting at the wheel. This is going to save lives. And you know what? All of that's still true. But I think there's this little bit of shock. Oh, you mean it's not perfect? I could still get in an accident. And isn't it worse? I mean, if you get in an accident and you caused it, that's one thing. If you get in an accident and you were just sitting there reading the paper and the car caused it, that's a lot scarier, isn't it? That's a lot more terrifying. Tesla knows exactly what happened because, yes, they record it all, and they even send it back to the factory. So as we've seen in other Tesla-ish incidents, crashes, and there have been other autonomous crashes, Tesla invariably will put a blog post saying, well, the driver said he hit the brake, but in fact he applied the accelerator pedal and drove right into that wall. And we know because we have, you know, see, the black box says that. So they do, they have all these recordings, and they say, in fact, nobody, the autopilot nor the driver, applied the brake. They just, and that's terrifying. Full speed plowed into that truck. Now, what do you think of autonomous vehicles? Even if we say they would save lives, they save other people's lives. They're not going to save my life because I'm an excellent driver. Well, let's talk about it. 8888 Ask Leo. Tech, you see, it's not just Nintendo video games anymore. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Website is techguylabs.com. You know, before we get to the calls, we're going to do that in a second. By the way, Scott Wilkinson's coming up to talk about home theater. I would say if you have a Tesla and you have these autonomous capabilities, that the right way to use it is to not to treat it as an autonomous vehicle. I think even Tesla would say this. Not to start reading a book while you're driving along, but to pay close attention. And I bet you this is what's going to end up happening is at least in the next 10 years, no state or locality or even federal government is going to say, hey, no problem, just ride along in your autonomous vehicle. That doesn't make sense, especially when most of the cars are not autonomous. It makes more sense if everything's autonomous, they can communicate with one another, and you wouldn't have an accident like this. But if only a few cars are autonomous, it's not really autonomous. Don't think of it as a self-driving vehicle. Think of it as driver assist. And I think that's the right way to think of it. This is to help you avoid an accident using your own brain in addition to the computer. Don't take your brain out of the equation. That seems like the sensible thing. And, you know, more and more, by the way, as technology progresses, more and more that's the case. We keep thinking, oh, soon we're going to be able to talk to the computers, they're going to do what we want. They're going to just kind of do their own thing. And more, it just seems obvious that the computer is an aid that goes along with your own humanity, your own human brain. And it's the symbiosis, the combination of the two, that is the most powerful. That by itself, a computer is still just a box of rocks, a really fast box of rocks, but still a box of rocks without the human element. Why take the human element out of it? You know, even if you're flying in a jet that's using autopilot, the pilots can't get up and leave the cockpit. They sit there at the controls and watch what's going on. Let's keep the driver in the loop. And actually, in this case, there's no evidence that this wouldn't have happened if the autonomous vehicle hadn't been on. I mean, would the driver have seen it? I don't know. I think so. Because I think the driver, see, I've noticed this. I'm thinking as I use things like adaptive cruise control. Yeah, I'm seeing stuff that the adaptive cruise control isn't. The cameras have limited vision, so you sense if a guy's about to change the lane. You can tell, right? You have human intuition. You look over there. The guy seems antsy. He's kind of moving a little bit. You could tell, so you slow down a little bit. You pay attention, and I think that's something a computer does not know and cannot do, and we're a long way off from that. 88. You agree, Kim? Would you let a car drive you home if you... You know, here's the question. If you were... Let's say you went out. You're a young person. You go out, perhaps have a adult beverage or two.
Too many beverages, yes.
Now you know you're impaired.
Yes. I think it's a great idea in theory, but...
Call an Uber.
Yeah.
Call a cab.
Then you're dealing with a human who might not necessarily be the best driver. But
I think we all live in the science fiction that someday we'll have HAL 9000 and it will be a human intelligence and we could take the brain out of it. And even with HAL 9000, now of course it was a movie, but you needed the human brain.
Yes.
Let's not take the human out of the equation just yet, I guess is what I'm saying.
Very scary.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. I'm sure you have some good ones. I see the board
is
full.
Greg right there in Dillon Beach.
I love Dillon Beach.
His echo is not cooperating.
Maybe he's got being unresponsive. A little sea spray in the echo. Hello, Greg. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. This is Greg. Thank you for answering. This may My question may hark back to your commentary on symbiosis between automation and humans, but I have an echo. Listening to your program, I have tried to talk to it using Amazon Echo and Alexa, and it will not respond. So I took it back to the dealership, and after $150, they said the Echo is totally fine and working perfectly.
You said it to Amazon.
Huh?
Where'd you get it?
From Toyota in Golden, Colorado.
Toyota?
Yeah. It's a Toyota Echo.
You're talking to a car, huh? Echo, are you related to the Toyota Echo?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question I heard.
Yeah, me neither. No, it's obviously Amazon makes those. So the clue was I took it back to the dealership. You can't talk to your car yet. Actually, like, this is the Amazon Echo I just talked to, and you get three choices on that. Amazon, I don't want to say the word that most people use, which is a lady's name beginning with Alex, or you can call it Echo, which is what I do, because I don't want people listening at home to have their Alex talking. Although all the time, we have one in the living room all the time, watching TV all the time. The Echo will say something, you know, like it's watching TV with us and then notices and thinks it was called and summoned. And then it, you know, it responds to it. So it happens by accident. But I don't think your car can. No. Lou in San Diego. Hey, Lou. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Uh-oh.
Did I do that thing again?
Yep.
Hello, Lou.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Pretty good. Pretty good. I wanted to first off thank your chat room. They helped me with a severe problem that I had with, I called about 3 months ago with my LG G4.
And they are really good. I should give them a plug. irc.twit.tv if you want to join them.
Well, I couldn't join them. I'm one of the computer imbeciles.
Oh, so did I relay what the chat room had said? Is that how
yes.
you? Yeah. Okay.
No,
good.
I don't believe you did. I don't know.
Somehow they managed to channel the answer to you.
Well, I found it. I was able to find it going back in the stuff. I don't remember if it was the same day or later.
Yeah. Okay. Good. But oh, you saw it on the website. Okay. Good.
I have another problem.
Yes.
Totally different.
Good.
I have a Gmail. I have two Gmail accounts. One of them, where I opened something from Dropbox from somebody I thought I knew, it was not because it was an advertisement for something.
Okay.
And I believe when I did that, all of my mail started to, from there. All of my inbox stuff went to trash.
From then on, everything's going into the trash.
Right. Right, so I guess that's better than being hacked, but...
That's weird. So you opened the mail, presuming it was Dropbox. Maybe it wasn't. That's what you're thinking, is maybe it was malware. And now when you go to Gmail, and you're doing this on the web page, there's...
I am doing it on my account.
Yeah. In a website, the Gmail website, right?
Yeah, I log into my Gmail account.
Yeah, using your browser. Yeah, I'm curious, because you can also use Gmail with, like, Apple Mail or Outlook or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you're opening your browser, you go to Gmail, and instead of seeing anything in your inbox, you go to the is it archives or?
It's trash.
Trash, and everything's in there.
Everything new.
All right, so you got to go. Now what you got to do is go to your filters. The only way this could happen is if you have a filter that says, and look carefully at your rules and your filters, that says when something comes, deal with it. You want to make sure it goes in your inbox as well as to the trash if it's spam. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'd love to hear from anybody who is a Tesla driver and has used the autonomous features, what you think about that. And whether now you're a little more nervous about it, or whether you knew all along that one should just pay attention. You know, it's interesting. And somebody in the chat room pointed out, you know, in the same 24-hour time span, literally hundreds of people have died on American freeways from their own error. So one autonomous vehicle death in 130 million miles is nothing, yet it isn't nothing. It is absolutely something, and it's I think it carries a lot of weight. I'd love to hear from Tesla owners what you think about all this. 8888, ask Leo. That fella, that guy right there, you may think Santa Claus is here early, but no. It's Scott Wilkinson, home theater guru. At the he is the editor at the AVS Forum, avsforum.com, where he puts a lot of great content together. That has become, by the way, nice job.
Thank you.
Become one of the, I think now the premier online source for home audio and video information. It really is good.
Thank you.
It was always
Thank
a great forum. It was always a place you'd go to hear from other users. And,
right.
And that's still there. But now the editorial content is so good. Well done.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I enjoy my job so much. You know what they say, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life kind of thing.
Well, but like a lot of writers, you were working for traditional media, magazines.
I was. For most of my career, I was a print jockey.
But that isn't really, nowadays, that's not maybe such a good career path.
Well, no. And I have to tell you, even with most of my experience in print journalism, I'm so happy to be strictly online right now.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't, you know, you don't have to fit to a page. You just write whatever you need to write. And the only difference is with print, you write and you edit and you get ready to print, and then the print deadline comes and then you can relax for a little while.
You're never
then the
finished
cycle
online,
starts.
Are you?
Yeah, you post something. It's okay. Where's the next one?
Yeah.
Okay. Where's the next one? Okay. Where's the next one? So there is a kind of a constant deadline struggle online, but I really wouldn't give it up. I really wouldn't go back to print myself.
We didn't talk about it last week, but you have the story. Value Electronics 2016 TV shootout happened last week.
Yep. Yep. We did.
Go ahead.
So we've got the results there, which in a very long thread, people are very interested in this event. And I also had on my podcast last Thursday, I had the owner or founder of the event, Robert Zone, and Joel Silver, the founder and president of the Imaging Science Foundation.
Well, set us up a little bit. What is this value shootup for people who haven't heard?
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely. So Robert Zone of Value Electronics, a retailer in Scarsdale, New York, I believe, so, you know, upstate New York a little bit, decided he wanted to put together, he wanted to put all the flagship LCD, well, TVs, flagship TVs from all the different manufacturers right up next to each other and calibrate them all, put them all on a level playing field and see which one was best.
Now, this isn't including less expensive sets. This is top-of-the-line sets in every category.
Totally right? Flagship sets. That's the only ones he does. Because he wants to see... He assumes that flagship TVs, the very best that Sony can do, the very best that Samsung can do, the very best that anybody puts out, will, and the best of those will be the very best TV in the world. And that's his assumption. And for the most part, I would have to agree with it. It may not be true in every single case, but for the most part. So he puts them all together. He invites people in and he says, okay, take a look. And we'll show you test patterns. We'll show you real content. And we'll you know, you vote. And he gives you a ballot form with each of the TV on it and with categories, you know, like black, the quality of blacks, the quality of the colors, the perceived contrast. And people vote on it. And so this year, it was held last week. There were only four TVs in the running. The LG G6 OLED, the only OLED. And then the Samsung KS9800, the Sony X940D, and the Vizio Reference Series 65. All of which are LCD TVs with what's called full array local dimming backlighting. So they do achieve better contrast, better black levels, still not as good as the OLED. And the OLED won the competition for the third time in a row.
Quite handily. I mean, it wasn't even close.
Well, and this was very interesting because many of the participants, when they came out, they reported, you know what, those TVs look really similar. And so on the podcast, I asked, how could it be that the TVs look so similar and yet their scores vary so widely because as you see there, the scores were pretty wide.
And this is all, and, by the way, again, on avsforum.com if you want to see the details.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly right. And Joel Silver, who actually sort of ran the show, who's a very knowledgeable, seriously guru video guy, said, well, because people were up there, you know, what we do call pixel peeping. We invite them to come right up to the screen and look at things very carefully and walk around and make sure you're on axis with all the TVs. And people were looking for little differences. And that's why the scores were wider than you might expect from just looking at all four TVs and saying, you know what, those look all very similar. They all look really good.
And that may be the bottom line of this for people listening, for normal consumers. Not only are all the top of the lines very similar, but really the trickle down is very good. And that means most the TVs that you're buying today are very, very good.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Is that fair to say?
It is very fair to say. And in particular, a lot of participants in the event came out saying, you know, every year the TVs that we see at this event, and there have been people who have been going to all 18 of them. This was the 12th one. Sorry.
Wow.
Sorry.
Wow.
This was the 12th annual one. And there have been people who have been to every single one. And they say, you know, every year the quality goes up and up and up. And I think by a corollary, it's also true what you just said, that that quality trickles down to the lower tiers.
Is there also some confirmation bias? Because one thing I do notice is that even going into this, there's wide agreement among all of the trade press about what the best set of this year is. And it's been that way for the last few years. You've called it. In fact, before we've gone into the shootout, you almost always say, well, this year, you know, the Kuros are going to clear winner. And or whatever, in this case, the LG G6.
OLEDs. Yeah.
OLEDs for the last few years, clear winners.
Yep.
So maybe they're just everybody's just kind of listening to everybody else and agreeing?
Well, you know, that's a very good point. Confirmation bias, there are a variety of, this was not a quote-unquote blind test either. People knew which TV they were looking at in each case. But the OLEDs clearly achieve the best blacks, black levels. And there are many people who say, if a TV achieves super good black levels, it's going to look better. That is the single most important criterion for picture quality.
Were all of these HDR UHD sets?
Yes. And okay. For the first time, they actually looked at high dynamic range, wide color gamut content on all these TVs, which presented a problem because there's no clear way to calibrate for high dynamic range yet.
Yeah. We should point out the Sony XBR actually came in second in almost every category and in fact, won in overall day performance.
Right, best with the lights
in daylight.
Which is how most people watch TV.
Yeah.
And it's with the lights on.
So if you couldn't afford, and I wouldn't be surprised if you couldn't, the G6, which is a very expensive TV, the Sony 940D might be a good next step down. And I'm pleased to see that because Sony, frankly, has been struggling lately.
Yeah, it's true. Now, the only size that TV is available in is 75 inches, so it's pretty big.
So it's not cheap either.
No. I forget the price. I'll have to look that up.
Find out more, avsforum.com. And don't forget to listen to the podcast this week. It's twit.tv/HTG for the Home Theater Geek Show. Thank you, Scott Wilkinson.
My pleasure.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sony, I think, came within inches of giving up the TV business. I mean, they've said for a while they're losing money on it. It's not a...
Yep, exactly right. Yeah. And did you hear that Panasonic actually has essentially pulled out of the U.S. TV market?
Oh, I see no Panasonic on here.
There wasn't any because they didn't have any.
Wow.
They're talking about maybe coming back in. They have an OLED, actually, in Europe. As well as one or more LCDs in Europe.
What's hard? Is it something about the U.S. market that makes it more challenging?
I suppose. I don't really know, to tell you the truth. You know, TVs, generally speaking, are on razor-thin margins. So the company doesn't make much money on them. The retailer doesn't make much money on them. It's a few percent margin, if anything. So that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
I don't know what else it might be, but TV makers are kind of dropping like flies and giving room to the Chinese. You know, we're seeing more TCL come in. We're seeing more Hisense come in. Those are the two big Chinese makers that you want to sort of keep an eye on because those are the ones that are going to come in and and make a splash here, I think,
right,
at some point. TCL should have had, and Hisense both, should have had a TV in that shootout. Unfortunately, the shootout took place in June, and those TVs aren't in the market yet. And that's another of Robert's criteria, is that he says it must be a production sample.
So next can't year. Be a, that's good. Yeah, so you know what? Year. Robert's right to do it that way, really.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
All yours for a few minutes, and then I'll take it back.
Cool,
you,
man.
You good for the top of the hour?
Yeah, yeah. Thank absolutely.
You. All right.
My pleasure. So there. Hey, everybody. UJ. Joel Silver did remark that the difference in quality between the flagship and next tier down is becoming closer and closer. That is correct. He did say that, and I believe it is true as well. Friendly Manitoba, want better black level. Don't get matte screen. That is true to a certain degree, yes. In fact, some of the LCDs that would otherwise have had a matte screen have a shiny black screen, the Samsungs in particular, in order to get a better black level. That's a problem with LCD TVs. They don't typically have good blacks. And the reason, part of the reason is that it's a transmissive display. So light has to transmit through something, in this case, an LCD panel. And so there's always going to be a little light leakage. The shutter in each of the LCD pixels, which lets more or less light through, is not perfect. It doesn't shut down completely. So there's always going to be a little light coming through. Now, the full array local dimming aspect of things, where you can actually dim down the backlight, helps with that and allows less light to get through. But it's not as good as OLED. It never will be. And that's just the way it is. So let's see if anybody else has any questions. Creamy Corn Cob pointed me to some glass speakers from Turtle Beach. I haven't played the demo yet. I haven't had a chance to, but they look pretty interesting. If those of you in the chat room go back to that, looks like it scrolled off of my screen. If you have it, and maybe Creamy Corn Cob can post that link again, they look kind of interesting. Hey, Sybil, live long and prosper. Dale Poco, for the shootout, were all TVs Insignia, et cetera, completely covered? No, they weren't. They were completely known to everybody. And that is one of the criticisms of this particular event. We used to do shootouts at Home Theater Magazine where we did do that. We tried to disguise which TV was which. It's not easy because they all have their own designs. And when they have their own designs and people are familiar with them, then they know. So it's almost impossible. I think I'm there. You go. My fingers are telling me it's time to go. I'll be around for the top of the hour, everybody.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. On the Vigo. Now, did you, Kim, the button? Let's talk about the button.
The button?
The button. I'm pushing the button, but it doesn't seem to do the thing the button is supposed
right
to do.
No, right now you've done it right.
Shall I press it? And it should be Jim from Simi Valley, right? Right?
You are Lou. You already have him on.
Why? No, that I just did Lou.
Oh. All right.
See? I pressed the button. It did the wrong thing. It does the pickup thing.
Okay, put everybody on hold because...
I don't know how to do that. Let me just press this button.
No, so Lou's on the air right now and you haven't talked to him yet.
Yes, I have. I'm sorry, but I have. All his Gmail's going to the trash can. Jim... in Simi Valley. I just have to push a different button now. So the next button's not working. That's what's going on. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Leo. I have Windows 7, and the issue that I'm having is when I search or if I do directions on a map, it always comes up with Richardson, Texas as first place.
Well, isn't that where you want to be, Richardson, Texas? Don't you want to... Actually, there's an interesting, and I'm not sure if this is related, but there's an interesting thing that goes on with geolocation. In fact, Cashmere Hill in the Fusion magazine wrote an amazing article about a poor family in Kansas. Poor not in the sense of they're not wealthy, but poor in the sense of unfortunate because their home in Kansas turns out to be in kind of close to the geographical center of the United States. And in a mapping situation, if the map can't figure out where something is coming from, it can't geolocate an address, it will pinpoint it on their farm in Kansas. And as a result, a great many people who are getting spam email or malware or solicitations will look up the IP address, and it will all go to this farm in Kansas. And they think this poor family, the Taylor family, who's lived there for 100 years, is the most evil family in America. And it's not. It's just because some mapping company put a pin in the middle of the U.S. and said, anything we can't geolocate in the U.S. is this. I'm wondering if Richardson, Texas, is doing the same thing for another region. So tell me how you're entering in. What are you doing?
If I do a search,
yeah,
Google or anything, for, say, a restaurant with a particular name,
yeah,
if there's one in Richardson, Texas,
it will,
that's the one that gets
okay.
It.
And that's because it thinks you're in Richardson, Texas. You see? So the question, you know, in other words, you're doing a local search. You know, we do this all the time. Show me coffee shops near me.
Yeah.
And you say, show me coffee shops near me. And it's in Richardson instead of in Simi Valley. So are you doing this on your phone?
No, I'm doing it on a laptop.
A laptop. And is the laptop, when you do this, always connected to your internet? Or is it at a coffee shop?
Always on mine.
So what's happening is exactly what I thought. Which is, somebody has associated your Wi-Fi, because you don't. Does your laptop have GPS built in? Probably not. Most don't.
No, it's Wi-Fi.
It's doing its geolocating by associating the Wi-Fi. It's actually, this is kind of an interesting technique. If you don't have GPS, and most computers don't, how do they know where you are? Well, there's a couple of ways. It can look at your IP address. It may be doing that. And your IP address, who is your internet service provider? Do you know?
AT&T.
So AT&T may have a headquarters or a regional office in Richardson, Texas, that IP address is associated with. That's one possibility and probably the case. So the computer says, well, let me see where I am. Oh, there's my IP address. Oh, that's in Richardson, Texas. Here's your locale. The other possibility is it's using a service that matches Wi-Fi access points to location. There was a company that did this, and I think they're still doing it, called Skyhook. And Google got in a little bit of trouble for doing something similar. Google, when they were doing the cars mapping the world, would at the same time as they're doing this also say, what open access, actually doesn't even have to be open, what access points do I see, and matching them to GPS coordinates. And it built a map. And by the way, it uses triangulation. So if there's multiple access points available, it'll look at the signal strength from each, and it'll pinpoint you based on that. So it may be doing that. It may be that either your IP address from your internet service provider is Richardson, Texas, and somehow that sounds like that's, you know, AT&T headquarters is in Dallas. So that sounds the most likely, right? Because it's really SBC, Southwest Bell, that took the name AT&T when they, like a giant shark, swallowed up all the little minnows. The other regional bells. It may be that for some reason, Skyhook or Google or somebody has incorrectly associated your access point. You're using Wi-Fi, right?
Correct.
Yeah, your Wi-Fi access point with Richardson, Texas. I think it's the former, though, almost certainly. There's not much you can do about that, except, is it Windows 7, 10?
7.
7. Yeah, I mean, Windows 7 is doing the best it can to geolocate you, which is look at the IP address. It says, oh, that's comes out of Dallas or a Dallas suburb, Richardson. The other thing you might check, you might try changing your Wi-Fi access point's name just, to see, because it may be that it's incorrectly being associated, probably isn't the case, but incorrectly being associated with the wrong location. I wonder if there's a way, and let me ask the chat room this, if there's a way to tell Windows 7, hey, don't use my IP address for geolocation. Use Wi-Fi. There might be. There might be. Which map are you using, Google?
Yes.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat room suggesting, I don't know if this will work, but that you clear your cache, your Google cookies for the map. Because that's the other thing. Google sometimes will associate a default location with you. Do you have a home address set in Google Maps? You can do that.
No, I don't.
Yeah, so go into Google Maps, set a home address, as your home address. That'll help. It's, you know, remember, it's doing the best it can given the information it has. Dr. Mom in the chat room saying maybe you have a refurbished router that was originally in Richardson, Texas. Because you are AT&T, I think almost certainly that's what's going on. That's the default location for an AT&T IP address. Give Google Maps more information, like specify your home address, specify your work address. You can do that in the settings of Google Maps. If it sees a home address, almost certainly will override Richardson, Texas, and say, oh, no, no, you're clearly in Simi Valley. This is really an interesting question, because how does your computer know where you are? You know, when you first set up a Windows machine, as one of the settings at the very beginning, do you want to set the time based on your machine's location, your time zone? And if you say yes to that, the computer will try to figure out what your time zone is. Well, how would it know? Well, it's the combination of all of those. Your IP address, that's the first signal. What Wi-Fi access points are nearby. And you've got to read this article by, I'll put a link in the show notes, by Kashmir Hill. The story came out in April. Internet mapping glitch turned a random Kansas farm into a digital hell. And the blame goes to a company that does this, by the way, that matches IP address to location. I can't remember their name. But these poor Taylors, this poor Taylor family, since 2002, oh, it's called MaxMind. So in 2002, MaxMind, a digital mapping company, decided it wanted to provide IP intelligence to companies that wanted to know the geographic location of a computer. So they assign a location to all IP addresses. They're probably who's assigned a location to your IP address. And if they don't know, they just put it in the geographic center of the United States, which unfortunately happens to be a farm an hour out of Wichita. And she's got people driving up saying, "You scammer, you," because they don't understand that IP address is just randomly mapped to our farm. And you shouldn't necessarily assume that what you can see in an IP address. By the way, it's longitude 3950 north, 9835 west. That's the center of the United States. And the port, somebody drove up their drive, because it's very rural, 360-acre farm, and left a used toilet in the driveway. They were so angry. So stop it, knock it off. This poor Taylor family did absolutely nothing. It's just the accident of mapping, internet mapping. Let's say, computers, is there nothing they can't screw up? Let's take a break. We'll come back with more. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'll put all this on the website so you can read it at your leisure. TechGuyLabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Lost iPhones, same thing. People would come and say, "You stole my iPhone." No, we didn't steal your iPhone. I know you did, see? It says, "My iPhone's here." No, it's not. Your iPhone doesn't know where it is. And so it's just decided it's somewhere in the middle of the United States. Scott Wilkinson.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! I shall once again return control of this fine radio show to the man with the beard. You, my friend, I will give you your time here.
I have
certain number of seconds.
Oh, okay, good.
You see it, right? Well, wait a minute, not yet.
I do.
You will in a moment.
Well, I was.
There you go. Now you've seen it.
Okay,
480
seconds. Cool.
Do your worst.
Thank you. One thing that Dr. Mom and I were talking about in the chat room, and I wanted to sort of alert everybody else to who might be interested in this, I posted a story recently about a meta-analysis of 18 different studies conducted over the last 30 years, roughly, that examines the results of these studies that each individually sought to test the hypothesis that humans can hear the difference between high resolution audio and CD quality audio. And this meta-analysis basically took these 18 different studies and transformed the data into a form that could be sort of lumped together and did a bunch of other stuff. It's actually quite sophisticated statistical analysis, which is often done in the medical industry, which is why I thought Dr. Bob might be interested in it. And it, what it found was very interesting, among many other things. It broke the participants in the studies. And by combining all these studies, there were 400 participants, over 400 participants, over 12,500 individual trials. It was able to, in many cases, break the participants into trained and untrained. And what that means is, if you're a trained listener, you might be a professional audio reviewer, or you might have received training in what to listen for. And you would have heard examples of here's high res, here's CD, notice the difference, you know, before the trials began. The trials, of course, should have been blind or double blind, which they mostly were. But if you got trained in what to listen for before you actually took the test, the results were very different than if you weren't trained. If for untrained listeners, they got slightly, and basically this meta-analysis looked at the number of correct answers in the is this high res or is it not high res kind of category. And among the untrained listeners, they were just over 50%, which means it's better than chance, but not by much. But it is. And in fact, that was determined to be statistically significant. But it was maybe only, 53%, something like that. But among the trained listeners, it was 60 to 70%. So that, to me, was very telling, because what it says is the real question is, should you spend extra money on high resolution? Well, if you're a trained listener, maybe so. Because you will be able to hear the difference, the improvement, presumably. But if you're an untrained listener, you know, maybe ever so slightly worth it, but probably not, I would say, in my opinion. And one thing that none of these tests really took into account that I would take into account in a study I did, is what's the equipment that you're listening on? Because if you're listening on, you know, even if you play high res music versus CD uncompressed music on some iPhone or smartphone or tablet or something, and you're listening on really crappy earbuds, you're probably not going to, even a trained listener probably won't be able to tell the difference. So the equipment that you're listening on, I think, makes a difference. This harkens back to the study. I did do a study, actually, very non-scientific. I will admit that up front right away. But I did a test on AVS, and I asked people, I gave them some files. One was a high res, and one was a CD res of the same music, the same recording. And I said, here's A, here's B, tell me which is which. And those with high res, with non-high res capable equipment, I also told them to tell me, what equipment are you listening to? Those without high res capable equipment were no better than chance, 50%, roughly. Maybe a percent or two higher than that. But, you know, again, this is not a scientific sample. Those who had the high-res equipment, the high-res capable equipment, were at 80% correct. So, admittedly, it was unscientific, but it was interesting. And this study seems to, well, this study doesn't talk about the quality of the equipment, which is what I think it would be very interesting to do in a scientific way. Mine was not. But it does say that if you're trained for what to listen for, then you will do much better. And if you are, then it may be worth, you know, paying the extra money. That's my conclusion. It's not this meta-analysis conclusion. Anyway, just wanted to let everybody know that. Twisted Mister, I just told you the final result of my test on this. Those without high-res capable equipment did no better than chance. Those with high-res capable equipment did really much better than chance. Bass Drum asked if there was any vignette on the LG OLED TV at the shootout this year, and the answer is no. They've solved that problem. Now, I didn't go to the shootout myself this year, but from every report I've heard, the vignette problem was gone. What wasn't gone, there was a problem with the LG TV with OLED, which was kind of surprising, is that if you go off-axis it started to pick up a kind of a greenish, cyanish tint to the color, which was very surprising to me. OLED is supposed to be, you know, immune to off-axis degradation, unlike LCD TVs, which have strong off-axis degradation. You sit right on axis, right in the center of the screen, and everything looks fine. But as you move off-axis, things start to break up. The contrast gets worse. The colors get less saturated. It starts looking pretty poor. And OLED, being an emissive technology rather than a transmissive technology, should be immune to that effect. And it is. It doesn't lose contrast, and the colors don't get less saturated, but they do shift. And I found that to be very interesting. So that was what the answer was there. Angry Ann, what about the average age of the person listening? That's a very good question. And the study does have information on that. This meta-analysis, I should say. Dividing by gender and by age, and talking about age as well, and hearing ability. Apparently, in some cases, they actually tested people's hearing ability, which is another thing that I would do in a scientific study. Absolutely. Yes, Twisted Mister Conky, I guess, asked the question about my test started with a 9624 recording, down-resed it to 44.6, and then pumped it back up to 9426 for them to be the same file size. We also level matched.
Thank you, Scott. See you next week.
My pleasure.
Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones and smart watches and autonomous vehicles and virtual reality headgear and OLED TVs and anything on your mind. 8888 Ask Leo. If it's got a chip in it, if it's technology, I love to talk about it. It is, it's not only fun, it's important. It's changing the world. 888-827-5536, and I love helping you navigate through this kind of changing landscape where everything looks like it's in Richardson, Texas, but in fact could be anywhere in the world. 888-827-5536. Dr. Mom or somebody gave me a link to a Google support page. Remember, our last call of the hour previous was my map on my computer thinks I'm in Richardson, Texas, and my strong supposition is, well, that's because your ISP, your internet service provider, is AT&T, which is based in Dallas, which is basically Richardson, Texas. And that's why your computer says, well, that IP address belongs to this locality. There is a help page on Google Maps. It says, help, I moved, and my Google Maps still thinks I'm in my old location. And the answer is there's no way to tell Google Maps otherwise. There used to be. There isn't anymore. But just keep using it. Eventually, it'll figure it out. And apparently, a week or two later, it does figure out where you are. That's because it associated your location with this kind of map of the world it's made of Wi-Fi access points. But it updates that regularly and eventually figures out where your Wi-Fi access point is. The IP address is a little more complicated. That goes back to, you know, who owns the IP address. When you're an internet service provider, you apply for and are assigned a pool of internet addresses that comes from a kind of super governmental organization called ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. It was originally set up by the U.S. Department of Commerce, but it's now kind of no country owns it. It's a non-governmental, supra-governmental organization. And it's in charge of saying, okay, you have this pool of IP addresses and you have this pool of IP addresses. Once an ISP is given a pool of IP addresses, by default, they're kind of assigned to the ISP's location. In time, perhaps, and maybe with the help of the internet service provider, it can be narrowed down. For instance, if you're a Comcast customer, if you look at kind of the reverse DNS, the DNS lookup, this is getting a little geeky here, but the you go to the phone book and you say, this IP address, where does it exist? Comcast has actually named it with the region. So Comcast is making some effort to associate pools of IP addresses with a region. AT&T may not do that. They may just say, well, we'll just assign it in order. Whoever gets it's next. So if that's the case, you can't rely on your IP address for your location information. But giving Google Maps your home address and your work address is going to help a lot. I think it's going to give it a much better sense of where you exist. It's an interesting question. One of the things I really enjoy about Coving technology is it's a different, it's kind of a different landscape. And things that we have learned over the years, you know, like you are where you are in the real world, don't apply so much in the internet, the virtual world. And so we have to kind of think a little bit like a machine, understand a little bit better about what our virtual life means. Fred in Upland. Oh, no, see, it didn't work. I pressed the next button. I can't do that. Let's go to, oh my gosh, Ranjit is in India. Hi, Ranjit, listening to the show in India. Where in India?
Hi, Leo. How are you? I'm from Bangalore.
From Bangalore, which is the tech capital of India, I'm told.
Supposedly, yeah.
You sound unconvinced.
No. It absolutely is.
Wonderful to talk to you. Thank you. I'm so glad you listen.
I'm actually a long-time listener and a fan.
Fantastic. What can I do for you?
Okay. Yeah, first a couple of things. That is, you know, I listen to your other podcast also.
Thank you. Tweet. Thank you.
Yeah, so I see that you are recommending Linux to a lot of people. So I would like to give a shout out to a particular distro called Elementary OS. I don't know if you have heard of that.
I am. It's very popular with people who like how the Macintosh looks. It's a version of Linux Ubuntu that's designed to look very beautiful and to have applications that are particularly favorable to people who are used to using Mac OS. Yeah, I like it a lot. It's a beautiful OS. Elementary.
Right, yeah.
That's your Linux of choice?
Yeah, I use that a lot. And it has, it runs on Ubuntu, but a lot of things that Ubuntu comes with, it has removed all that and streamlined pretty much. So it's very fast as well.
I'll have to check it out. I mean, I'm a Mac user. A lot of times, I think, a lot of Linux distros are trying to appeal to Windows users, that's Mint particularly, or Mac users, trying to get them to come on over to the other side, and which I think is not a bad thing at all. And one of the things Elementary's done is, besides just the look and feel, they've actually created apps, specific apps like the Photos app that will make people feel very comfortable if they're coming from a Macintosh in particular. I think that's in my opinion, a great wedge into, you know, getting people to start using Linux on the desktop. I love it. After you use it for a while, and I've been using it since 1998, you start to kind of want to go more native Unix. I think this is a great choice. I like it a lot. So thank you for the recommendation. Now, they say they want money, but you could do it for free, right? They ask for a donation, I guess.
Yeah. You can get it for free. Okay, I mean, it's just a donation.
Good.
Yeah. So, okay, my question is actually related to money here.
Ah, money. All right. The universal language.
So what I have is I have a YouTube channel where I put some, technical videos and stuff.
What's the channel? Let me see it.
That's my full name and it's a mouthful.
Okay. So step number one, make it a little easier. Okay. That's good. Cause if I can't ask you what's your channel and you can't just say, oh, it's great, Ranjit on Tech, then you got a problem. Right.
No, I would say if you go to Google and search how HashMap works in Java, I think probably the first video that pops up will be mine.
Okay, good. And, you know, that is the other way, by the way, and a very respectable way to get views is to make sure that when you're on YouTube, you're very much Google searchable since they own YouTube. Make, you know, have names that people will search for, right? So you do a lot of Java-focused stuff. I found it, by the way. And there you are. This is good. How HashMap works in Java with animation. See, this is smart because people can easily find this, right?
Mm-hmm. So the problem, Leo, here is I have published about 10 videos over the past few months, and I have about 6,000 subscribers. And
good. I mean, this video alone has 80,000 views. That's remarkable.
Right. So I was also so excited, but I see that YouTube doesn't pay you well at all.
No.
Okay? Even though
no.
I have enabled ads and stuff like that.
No. Not, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm looking to know what are the other ways to monetize on something like this. If I have to build something on my own, what are the tools and things like that that I have to look for?
This is really, this kind of strikes to the core of something I've been talking a lot about and thinking a lot about. People, YouTube is an amazing thing. I mean, it just gives you free bandwidth. It gives you global distribution. They do a great job. It's where all the users are. Because it's Google, it's very, you know, search works quite well. If you're into Java, you're going to find, Ranjit, you're going to find your videos. If you're into HashMap and you want to know how it works with Java or factory method design patterns in Java, that's going to show up and people are going to see the tutorial. And you know what? You're benefiting from that because, you know, you 80,000 views, 78,000 views, 10,000 views, that's a lot, especially for specialized content. But you ask the right question, which is, well, but how do I make money on this? And when we're going to have to take a break, but hang on. I know you're on Skype, so it's not costing you. Hang on. We'll answer that when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's kind of the dirty little secret of YouTube, which is that even if you have a million views, and I know people with millions of views, and they make $100, $500, $1,000. And how hard is it to get a million views, right, Ranjit? I mean, it's not.
Yeah, it's not
easy.
It's very hard.
So, in general, and this isn't on the radio, but it will be on the podcast. In general, what my feeling is, YouTube is a great promotional vehicle, but it is not a great way to make money by and of itself. Some people do, but in order to make money, you have to have consistently a million views on every video. If you made $1,500 for 1.5 million views, which I think is about right, and you made a video every day that did that, you'd be very, very happy. But that's PewDiePie. There's not many people that can do that. And sad to say, right, the way you do that is by making, by pandering, by making viral videos. There ain't no Java, no video about Java is going to get that kind of views unless you say 10 reasons why Java is the most dangerous language ever written or something like that, right? Because then you're currying views. You have to focus on getting views. And even then, I don't think you get properly rewarded. A million views and $1,000 is not properly rewarded. Google, in my opinion, uses YouTube to take advantage of people. I mean, but only if you think you're going to make money on it. But Google kind of promotes that idea, right? The top $50 million money makers on these guys are breaking it in. They're superstars. They promote the stars. And really what I think is appropriate is to say it's a wonderful promotional vehicle, a great way to make videos. Did you do it hoping to make money on it?
Yeah, I'm actually looking to see if that's something that I can make out of this, like a career or a business.
Yeah, you should see this. You should see this as a way of promoting your name as somebody who knows this stuff. And then even Michelle Phan, who is one of the top 5 or 10 YouTube people, most of her money is not made on YouTube ads. It's made selling makeup, monthly makeup kits, right? Mm-hmm. And even PewDiePie, who makes, one thinks, a lot of money, when they give you the amount of money he makes, a lot of that includes side deals, ad deals. You know, it's not directly from YouTube advertising. So it's really, I'm going to say this on the air, but I wanted to kind of go a little bit deeper with you. It really, you have to use it to promote your business in some way, or some way to make money outside of YouTube. I mean, you're doing a great job. I mean, given that you have looks like 10 videos, you're doing great. But you're never going to – but even with this great success – and believe me, 80,000 views of a YouTube video on Java programming is phenomenal. But it's not going to make you rich. It's not even going to make a living.
Yeah.
And that's what you've discovered. I think to some degree, Dr. Morbius in our chat room says YouTube is feudalism is absolutely right. You are a serf working on it, but only if you don't know any better. And that's why I'm always banging this drum. And people get mad at me. They say, no, look, all these people making money on YouTube. Yeah, no, not really. Okay, hang on. We're going to come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, Ask Leo. We're talking, and this is a great conversation. We're talking with Ranjit Ramachandran. Chardran, did I say it right? Ramachandran?
You got it.
I got it.
You got it right.
He's got a great YouTube, a really great YouTube channel for Java programmers. And by the way, I can see you've put a ton of effort into this, and you're getting great results. I mean, given your subject matter, you're getting remarkable, I think, results. The one we were talking, how hash maps work in Java, in 11 months, you got 80,000 views. But this is a 15-minute video on a very abstruse topic for Java programmers. But because people can find it, this is great. But how much money have you made, if I may ask? You have monetization turned on?
Yeah. On every video, I have it. And I'm stuck at nearly like $40 to $45 total.
Total?
Yeah, okay. That's where it is.
Total. And you put hundreds of hours into these 10 videos you've got up here. I guarantee you. I know. I can see the work you put in. You've got animations. You've got illustrations. You're doing a great job. And by the way, you have a huge amount of expertise, years, obviously, programming Java that you're building into this. And so that's another thing that you need to get paid for. It's not merely the effort putting into this particular video. It's the knowledge of after years of work. This is real value. YouTube is never going to pay you what you're worth, period.
Okay.
Period. And that's the most important thing for people to realize. And I think YouTube does not look, you, as I said, YouTube is a great and valuable thing. It's free bandwidth. You're posting video, and it's available to 1.5 billion internet users worldwide, and it's searchable. And by simple virtue of that, it's a great resource. They muddy the waters, I think, by putting ads on it and then implying by really promoting their stars that you could become a millionaire with YouTube videos. You can't unless you make videos of a certain kind that appeal to a certain type of viewer. You pander. And I mentioned off the air, if you made a video that said 5 reasons no one should ever use Java because it's a killer, the language, you will die from using it. If you made that video, you might get a lot of views. You're not going to get 1 million views with the kind of subject matter you do. And you shouldn't, and you don't need to. What you need to understand is that YouTube is not a living. YouTube is a promotional vehicle. And so anybody who puts stuff on YouTube, bravo, wonderful, because you're not only are you, you know, you're contributing to YouTube, you're contributing to the world by, it's just like anybody who puts up a blog and writes stuff, by taking your knowledge, your information, and giving it away freely to the world. That's a great contribution. Thank you. But you want to make a living, everybody needs to. You got to just see this as promotional. It's like, and YouTube doesn't do a good job, I think, of expressing this. And I feel like there are a lot of kids, young people who have a dream of being a YouTube star who don't get how much work it is and what a long shot it is. You're more likely to become a star in the National Basketball Association, frankly, than you are a YouTube star. I mean, seriously, it's just a long shot. And it's going to be a certain kind of video, a viral video that I think is not a huge contribution, incidentally, to internet culture or thought, or it's not brainy material. It's lowest common denominator material. That's how you get millions of views. It's junk, frankly. Entertaining junk, but junk. And if you want to use YouTube, you got to use it just to find. Now, your task, you've done a great job, is to think of, well, how can I use it? You wouldn't ask, if you go around handing out business cards, you wouldn't say, well, how much revenue am I going to get for handing out these business cards? You wouldn't expect that. And that's where I think YouTube has let people down by implying that there's a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow. No, it's handing out business cards. The job is now monetizing the views you get in some other way, whether you have a business. You know, if you have a business doing this, are you trying to get contract work as a Java programmer?
I already have a full-time job on that, but I'm looking to probably move on to a different because I like
this. And you're going to build your brand.
Yeah.
Now, there are things you can do to make your brand more accessible. I don't think most people are going to remember Ranjit Ramachandran. Maybe you got to go Ranjit the Java guy. You know what I'm saying? You have to think in terms of building a brand so that it's memorable, and then that you can capitalize on it in some way. So you need to kind of make a business plan and a model and think about how can I use this calling card now to benefit me long term. Maybe seminars, Java seminars. I don't know. I don't know. But everybody should understand that the money you make on YouTube, and by extension, on a blog with Google AdSense and stuff like that, is small potatoes in almost every case. It doesn't pay you for your time and effort. Really, what YouTube's giving you, the real value, is free bandwidth, a free place to put it, and a wide potential audience. That's the real payoff, not the money they send you. $45, that's not going to pay you for. I mean, you put a lot of work into this, and years of learning about Java.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish YouTube were better, frankly, at communicating this, because they spend a lot of time promoting YouTube stars, and that's a very thin shell of success on top of what 99.999% of YouTube is. Okay.
All right, Leo, I hear what you say. I get your point.
Yeah, okay. I hope it's not disappointing to you. I know you've been doing this for a year. You put a lot of work into it. These are great.
I'm going to use YouTube as my business card.
It's a business card. It's an ad. It's a flyer, an ad flyer. Yeah. Yep. Thank you, Ranjit. Great to talk to you. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, too.
It's Ranjit, the Java guy. Ranjit on Java. I like it. It kind of has a ring to it. Ranjava. Think of a, you know what I'm saying? Our show today, I have mixed feelings about this. It's a great vehicle. As long as you understand what it is, the limitations of what it is. And yeah, Elementary OS, that's a great recommendation. Thank you, Ranjit on Java. I like it. More of your calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Stay right here. Hey, this is a good time for me to mention our sponsor on the show today, ZipRecruiter. If you are in the position of hiring at your company, or if you're a sole proprietor, you know that hiring is both challenging and rewarding. It can be, of course, really tough, especially when you're in a position where you're shorthanded. You know, if it's just you and another person and the other person quits, you got to get that new hire fast. But at the same time, hiring the right person can make all the difference in the world. A great employee transforms a company. ZipRecruiter makes it possible for you to reach out to that. There's that one person there. By one click of the mouse, you can post to 100-plus job boards and Facebook and Twitter. And you'll get many, many, matched up to many, many resumes. I think something like 6 million current resumes in their database. Plus, all of their potential candidates roll into their interface. You don't get I love this. You don't get the emails to your inbox or the phone calls to your inbox. They go into the ZipRecruiter interface where it's very easy to screen, rank, and hire the right person fast. Big deal here, a lot of the younger people, if you're hiring a millennial, they want to do it on mobile. And yes, ZipRecruiter works great on mobile. Embrace the mobile job seeker, they say. Post once and you'll watch your candidates roll in. You'll find the right person fast. No wonder 800,000 businesses use ZipRecruiters, including us. I think we hired our most recent editor via ZipRecruiter. More than 125 million candidate applications have been delivered. It's fast, it's easy. And you can try it free right now at ZipRecruiter.com/TechEye. ZipRecruiter.com/TechEye. 4 days free waiting for you. We thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. He's been everywhere, man. He's been all around, man. Right now he's in line, man. He's Johnny Jet, our traveling man. Hey, Johnny Jet!
Hello, aloha.
Aloha. Welcome. Where are you?
I'm still in Hawaii. I'm on the island of Oahu. I was at the Four Seasons of Oahu. Then I flew to Lanai to check out the new Four Seasons there. And now I'm at the Modern Hotel and I'm about to check out, go to the airport and see if I can get bumped, make some money because the flights flight is oversold.
Oh, wait a minute. You're going to try to get bumped.
Heck yeah. Stay another day in paradise. Make $500 in cash voucher so I can use on another flight.
Oh, man.
So
do you recommend? So this is Larry Ellison's island, Lanai, which used to be the royal island where King Kamehameha lived. And it was, I think, economically not doing too well. Larry Ellison, the Oracle billionaire, bought it. And you're saying he's beloved there?
He is beloved there. You know, everyone was skeptical when he came in, but he turned the island around. There's only three hotels. Two of them are Four Seasons. They closed them both down and remodeled them all. Instead of laying everyone off, there's 3,500 people, by the way, on the island. He found new jobs for them and cultural stuff to, like, create gardens and just fix up the whole island. And he opened up a community pool, a movie theater. And so far, everyone loves him. And it's good to know because that island almost closed down. And it was known for its pineapples. 30 years ago, it was a huge pineapple plantation for Dole, and they closed it down. They don't even grow one pineapple on the island anymore.
Really? Dole just moved out. Yeah.
They just moved out.
Wow.
Overseas.
Wow. This looks beautiful. That's really
It's
great.
Expensive, but it is prime time.
Yeah. Well, Larry's got to pay. He's got to get his payback.
Yes.
Nice. 75-inch TV. Okay, I'm going.
Yes.
Why would you go? Why would you go to one of the most beautiful places in the world and watch TV? Because
at night you turn on a tube.
We're American.
Yeah, that's true. There's also a TV in the bathroom in America.
Of course, because one wouldn't want to spend a second without the boob tube constantly present.
Although I did not turn that on.
Good for you.
Yes.
So now Johnny doesn't join us to talk about all the places we can't afford to go. Johnny joins us. He also joins us to talk about using your phone, your web for better travel, usually a website and an app. What do you got?
So I got a website for you. It's called Review Skeptic. It's brand new.
I like the name.
So everyone, you know, knows about hotel reviews, especially like TripAdvisor, but no one knows that they can believe them because there's always either competitors or disgruntled workers bashing the place, or there's a PR people or the hotel hiring people to, you know, make these – you know, fake glowing reviews. So this site was actually created by or based on the research at Cornell University. And they're telling you to go into a review, copy and paste it into their site, and it will tell you the chances of it being accurate or not.
Wait, how does it know?
Just certain words that people are using. And so they say it has a 90% accuracy rate. So I went and I looked at one of the reviews for actually one of the Four Seasons hotels that I was at. And that I thought was real, and I put it in there, and sure enough, they said, yeah, it's real.
Oh, interesting.
So
yeah, I think some of us also have that capability. I mean, we can look at a review and
I don't know, actually.
Really?
I have a friend who worked for a hotel, and the owner used to make all the employees spend the night in a hotel. He would actually have to pay for the hotel because one of the review sites makes sure that you actually have a confirmation number and all that stuff. So they would spend the night, and then they would have to go in the next day and write these glowing reviews.
Oh, man. All right.
So
well,
it's very difficult.
This could be human written. It just means that it's – so I'm entering – I was just at the Pelican Hill, as you know, in beautiful Newport Beach. I've got a 5-star review from TripAdvisor. Let me – paste this in.
Well, you got to pick one of the reviews that are in there.
Yeah.
You can't just pick the whole thing.
Oh, I can't just paste in some.
You just can't paste
it
in.
It says
like
it's truthful. It says it's truthful.
But so was that just one review?
Yeah,
one picked?
Review. I pasted in from TripAdvisor.
Okay.
Blue, if it's blue text, it sounds right. If it's red text, it sounds wrong. Like, I decided to give it another try. Deceptive. Right?
Well, but there's a lot of red in that.
It gets better and better. That's deceptive. On the other hand, there is a lot of red in it, but there's also a lot of blue. Like words like so if and follow and wonderful are blue. So, but they decided this is essentially truthful. But this is interesting. So based on Cornell University research.
And Cornell University, I believe, is a very good hotel school.
Oh, yeah. Cornell's great. Yeah. If you're worried,
for hospitality,
take these suspicious reviews and paste them into reviewskeptic.com, and it's free.
And what it's also cool about the site is if you know that a site a review is fake or real, to alert them so they can better manage the other reviews.
So it can learn. Yeah.
Exactly.
I like this.
So,
Yeah.
So now I got an app for you. This one you're going to love. If you haven't heard it, this one's been around. It's called The Fork. T-H-E, Fork, F-O-R-K.com.
Yeah.
So it's an app. So it's for when you're going to dinner, mostly in Europe. They have one country in South America, Brazil. But Brazil, Belgium, France, Denmark, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, and Turkey. And it's free on Android and iOS. But what this will tell you is it will give you a discount up to 50% at more than 30,000 restaurants.
What?
And it's a foodie community. It's kind of like Yelp where the community. But these guys will give you discounts. I've never used it, but I contacted one of my friends who's in Europe. I said, please check this out. And they said, we've used it many times, and we love it.
So we're going to the restaurant Jules Verne and the Eiffel Tower.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. In September.
I don't know if they're going to have a discount for that.
Yeah, that is... we already paid for it. It's weird. You have to pay before you go. You send them money, a lot of money, and they send you a box. And in the box is a reservation number and a phone number. And then you can call and make a reservation after you buy it already. It's very, but it's French. What do you expect? Of course, they're going to have some crazy, convoluted way, but we're very excited. It's an Alain Ducasse restaurant.
And by the way, you can spend the night in the Eiffel Tower this summer. I think it's HomeAway. I remember reading a press release.
Somebody's got an Airbnb in the Eiffel Tower?
Yes. You have to win it, I think. There's seven nights that they're giving away. Not all at once. Just seven different people are going to win one night in the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, I'd love to do that. But there's not a hotel there, is there?
I think it's HomeAway. It could be Home Exchange. I'm pretty sure it's HomeAway.
What fun.
So, yeah.
Wow.
And what else I got for you? So when you're going to Europe?
The Fork. We're going to Europe September 22nd through October 4th.
Okay. Well, I got a European tip for you then.
Okay.
So if you're renting a car, you got to be careful of Europe's newest speed trap that the Wall Street Journal called, by the way.
What is it?
Because they have so many more automated radar cameras all around Europe, and that people are renting cars, and when they get home, even sometimes months later, they're getting a ticket from either the rental car agency or from the country saying, you know, you owe us, you know, a certain amount of money. And, you know, they say it's a good idea to pay it, although there are scammers out there. So you got to contact the car rental agency before you pay it to make sure it's legit.
Holy cow.
But if you're renting a car, that is something you need to worry about.
Be aware.
Or look
you know at. How you would know that? You would go to JohnnyJet.com. That's how you would know. Great articles. It's Johnny's website. It's totally free. He's got a bunch of email newsletters you can get, again, totally free with deals. And I mean, it's just really a great service you provide, John. I don't know how you make a living, but God bless you for doing it. I feel like I'm like YouTube. You're just using this. This is your business card. So I'm going to give you a plug here. Go to JohnnyJet.com. Follow Johnny on Twitter, @JohnnyJet, because he's got and the lists on there. Check out his lists.
Sign up to the newsletters. That's how I get the sponsors. People click
the
ads.
That's how you make the money? All right, get the newsletter. Yes. It's free, but that's beautiful. It's like this radio show. You get the benefit of it.
For sure. And I just came from an influencer summit, and they had YouTubers there. And these guys worked their tail off. The whole time in the meeting was editing.
Yeah. Of course. He can't sit down for one moment. And
they
even then, they don't make great money.
And they edit for 7 hours.
And do they make a wonderful living?
This guy makes pretty good money.
Okay. All right. But he works his butt off.
I don't know exactly how much money he makes, but right. Yeah.
Johnny, I don't care how much money you make. You come back here for free every day. I love it. JohnnyJet.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm just teasing you. But you wouldn't. I think you've got a much better a way of doing this than if you were just on YouTube. I think it's very hard to make a living on YouTube.
Well, I had a viral video once. I had a video go viral once.
Yeah.
That was that Fallen Soldier. But I didn't put an
amazing.
Ad on it.
Right.
I didn't put an ad on it until one of my friends was like, you should put an ad on it. I was like, I really don't want to. But I did it just to experiment the last 500,000 views.
Yeah.
And it made a little bit of money.
Like how much? Like $1,000?
I can't remember.
It was like 500 bucks.
I think every million views, you can make $3,000 or something like that.
Okay.
That's what I was told. I'm not sure if that's accurate. But it is, you know, some of these guys are getting a lot of views.
I know they are. But I think it's interesting that it's never clear how much money they make from it. It's like they don't want to talk about it. YouTube doesn't want to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's accurate, but someone out there must know.
Somebody knows. Well, there's a site that claims to know, but I don't even believe it.
And what do they say?
There, I can't remember what the name of the site is, but you can go there and ask how much somebody's making on YouTube. I don't know, but see, YouTube never reveals that information, so they're kind of making it up.
Well, all right.
Have a good one.
Pack my bag.
All right, my friend.
All right, take care.
Have a great trip. I hope you get bumped.
I need some money. Get 5 minutes. I make my money.
Love to Natalie. Take care.
See ya.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number. Bill is on the line from Glendora, California. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Thought I'd call in and let you know I'm a owner of a Model S.
Tesla. Ah, Tesla Model S. And do you have the autonomous feature?
I certainly do and love it.
Do you use it?
I use it almost every time I'm in the car. If I'm on the freeway, it's usually on. And
let me ask you what degree you use it. Do you let it change lanes autonomously?
Well, one thing you said about it changing lanes, it will not change lanes unless you turn on the turn signal.
That's right. You have to tell it to change lane, and then you let it go, though, right?
Yeah, but I will say that it sometimes can be a little bad. Bad Tesla when it wants to change lanes. So
I'd be nervous about that. By the way, lanes changing is the most dangerous thing you do on a highway.
That's right. And so usually I look first before I turn on the turn signal, make sure I got plenty of room.
Of course, but, you use the adaptive cruise control. You trust that?
Yes. Yes.
Would you tell it set a course and take me home?
Well, it can't take you home because once you're on the freeway, it just keeps on going, but it can't go off. It cannot turn off an off-ramp or take you to your house.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought it could because I've seen videos of people taking off-ramps in Teslas. But I guess you'd have to use this turn signal to do that.
Maybe. Well, they're maybe using the turn signal, and that's about it.
That looks nerve-wracking. But if you're just driving down the freeway, you'd let it do that, right?
Yeah, in fact, the greatest thing about it of anything is in stop-and-go traffic. You just let it stop and go by itself,
right.
And you just sit back. It's the greatest thing in the world.
And, you know, I've used that on my Audi. I mean, adaptive cruise control is available on a variety of vehicles that does that. And I feel completely safe on that. Now, I don't take my eyes off the road. You're not going to read a newspaper, are you?
Well, I've kind of done some bad things.
Uh-oh.
I mean, last week I was going down the freeway about 80 miles an hour, and I was going through a real big sweeping turn, and I was in a number two lane, and there was a bunch of young people in number one diamond lane next to me, and I literally was kind of bouncing around a little bit because we're going kind of fast, and I was texting with both hands, and they were all staring at me, pointing, noticing that we were sweeping around.
You're setting a very bad example for the youth of this country.
No. But I've gone all the way from the San Gabriel Valley all the way to Santa Barbara in the Diamond Lane, 85 miles an hour with autopilot on. And
I mean, it's a boon if you're in bad traffic. Anybody that lives in L.A., this is a boon.
It's great. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, how nervous were you when you first started using this?
Well, the first couple of times, you are very nervous.
Yeah.
And then you start understanding kind of what to look out for. Again, you shouldn't be doing dumb things. I'm going to kind of scale back my dumb things right now based on what's happened recently. But
that's interesting, too. So you do feel that fatality is a cautionary tale.
It is, but you got to with the understanding is that the witnesses said that that guy passed somebody at 85 miles an hour and flew by that person. And that person said they didn't know how fast he was going, but he was hauling buns.
Yeah.
And then he's watching Harry Potter, evidently, on a DVD.
Yeah, I read that in the story, although they pointed out that was the truck driver said that. Now, remember that somebody...
He said he came to the vehicle...
And the Harry Potter was playing. Right.
But he didn't see it. But they definitely had a DVD player, evidently, in the car. Also, this gentleman had 8 speeding tickets in the last 6 years. That kind of tells you something.
It may be that even without the autonomous vehicle, he would have had a problem sooner or later.
Yeah, because you can't stop that fast if someone pulls right out in front of you.
So like, you feel safe. You feel safe using the autonomous vehicles of your Model S, autonomous features.
Well,
of your
Model S. And in fact, I feel uncomfortable now when I'm driving myself, and that's probably the scariest thing. Sometimes I forget that I'm driving instead of the car. I have to remember to hit the brake.
That's a real risk, isn't it? I haven't turned it on, but I think I have.
Yes, and when you use it so often, you get into this thinking that, oh, the car's taken care of, and you, all of a sudden you realize, oh, I better hit the brakes now. Yeah. And that's another thing, too, is if you're on the autopilot and the car does stop by itself and abruptly maybe, you have to remember not to hit the brakes, or if you do physically
it'll disable
hit the brakes
it.
Yourself, it'll disable it. Yeah. You better stay on the brakes.
You know, my car, and I rarely had experience of this, although my wife has more experience of it, will, if you get too close to a vehicle, flash red, beep, and jam on the brakes even, whether you've got autonomous features turned on or not. This is a standard, you know, gas Audi. So we're seeing more and more of these features, and they think of this as driver assist. And I think that that's – do you agree with me, Bill, that the right way to think of this is – you're driving, but you've got stuff in the car that's going to help you be a better driver.
Yeah, you know, we're level two right now, so people sometimes aren't confusing that with level four. They can go to sleep. And some of those videos you see are people just joking around. You can't fall asleep in a Model S.
You shouldn't.
You can't, because it literally gives you an audible alarm first, and then it gets louder.
Right.
And then eventually it'll slow down and stop, my understanding. I've never gone that far, but you can't fall asleep.
No, your hands have to be on the wheel.
Yeah, but the car's amazing. I love it, and it's the greatest vehicle I've ever purchased. And
full disclosure here, I have a deposit down on a Model X and should be taking delivery in the next couple of months. So, and I got all the autonomous features as much because I feel like I should be reviewing it and be aware of it.
Sure.
As a desire to use it. But same reason I got the Audi with all of those features, because they add up. It's going to be very expensive. I think it's important to know what's going on. You know, I can see a day where every vehicle is autonomous. And then I think I would feel very safe.
But obviously, we got to get there somehow. And, you know, Tesla is actually monitoring what's going on. And they're learning from all this. And that, to me, was nothing more than code bad programming, because Elon said that obviously the radar did see that truck, but they have some kind of code in there written that maybe that signage, because of below the truck, there was nothing there. The truck was very high up.
Right. So it could have been a sign, and they didn't know that the car couldn't pass under it, so it attempted to.
Yes, and my thought was as well, you know, that radar should have seen, should have had code that saw that the truck was actually even moving. That should have got a signal from that.
Yeah.
But obviously they didn't write that in. But if a truck was stalled, it would have still been pretty pretty bad shape. But nevertheless, I think that's not too bad when you consider yesterday the government released figures for deaths for the year 2015 with automobiles. And it's 35,200 people now as of 2015, up 7.7%. So, you know, if right now we're probably hovering around 36 or 37,000 if the trend continues this year, I'll take my chances with my Model S. I figure I drive 15,000 miles a year. That means it would take me maybe close to 9,000 years before I get killed.
Good luck in those nine. You just hope it's not early in the 9,000 years. Hey, Bill, I'm really glad you called, because I wanted to get the perspective from somebody who's using it, who's a driver right now. That's great. Thank you. Sure. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, and I think everybody who uses these features will approach it with a little more caution. But I like what you said, Bill, which is that every company, and this is true of Google as well, every time something happens, they reassess their code and they look at how it's done and what they can do to do it better. So it will get better. One of the kind of theoretical questions people often raise with autonomous vehicles is, all right, would you drive in a car that would have code that would sacrifice your life to save more lives by not, let's say, running into a school bus? You know, are they going to write code, ethical code in here that chooses the best outcome overall rather than the best outcome for you, the owner? I don't know if they're considering that. You know, if I were writing the code, I would say just do the best you can. I'm not sure I would write code in saying, well, is that going to save three lives compared to one? I don't think I'd code that in. I'd just say attempt to avoid the accident at all costs. Do whatever you have to do. And then if it can't, well, then you have to let the chips fall where they can. I'd love to talk to somebody who writes autonomous vehicle code to see if they're actually considering ethical conundrums or if they're just going to say, no, we're just going to drive as well as we can. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, our show today brought to you by Epson, another fine sponsor. Epson brings us not only the radio show, but the podcast as well. And the reason is they want to get the word out on this, the EcoTank printer. And I think that folks at Epson felt like this needed a little explanation. I think it's like, wow, you guys, it's about time. Well done. But they think they're concerned that it needs a little explanation. The EcoTank printers are the state-of-the-art Epson Precision Core inkjet printers. They're really, really great. I've had Precision Core printers for a long time. I've been talking about them for a long time. It's the Precision Core engine is that industrial engine they brought down from their big printers, 40 million drops a second and all of that. But what they've done that I think is so great with the EcoTank is they've replaced the ink cartridge with a tank of ink. Cartridge-free printing. And in the box, it comes with enough ink for 2 years. And I think that's why they think it needs a little explanation, because that means it's going to cost a little more up front, but you don't have to buy ink for 2 years. And incidentally, when you go back to the market, you know, after 2 years to buy more ink, you're going to save up to 80% with these low-cost replacement bottles or, on the big one, the packs. The EcoTank line of Super Tank printers, it's a breakthrough. Take a look at the ET4550. That's the one Lisa bought for the house, and I love it. I set it up. Easy to set up. You've got the bottles in the box. You pour them in, and you get this great printer. The new EcoTank ET4550 is a wireless all-in-one printer. Doesn't use ink cartridges. It features that innovative, refillable ink tank. And it won the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. So they also got the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. Now, if you're at a big work group or business, take a look at the WFR4640. 20,000 black pages worth of ink or color pages in the box. And, of course, because it's Precision Core, love these Precision Core printers, you're going to get high speed, vivid colors, laser quality black text, plus auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder. And, yeah, they print wirelessly from your tablet, from your smartphone. This ET4550 serves the entire house. It's on the Wi-Fi. It's fantastic. Epson also just released their creative print app, which means it's easy to put your Instagram or Facebook photos in a photo book, download the app, and create personalized photo collages, custom greeting cards, stationery, and coloring book templates. It's free for Epson printer owners. You can even print directly onto CDs and DVDs. Be creative on the go. Print from your mobile device to a variety of compatible Epson all-in-one printers with your wireless network. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to transform the way your home, your office, your work group prints for the best combination of ease and value. Turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers, E-P-S-O-N, Epson.com/EcoTank. We thank them for their support for the Tech Guy podcast. Thank you, Epson, and for reinventing, I think, the printer business. I love it. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers for sure, the internet possibly, home theater, hi-fis, surround sound, stereo watches, smartphones, virtual reality, autonomous vehicles, anything like that. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's my phone number, 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. You don't have to remember that number. You don't have to remember anything. Just go to Tech Guy. Well, remember this, techguylabs.com. That's the website. And if you go to techilabs.com, there are phone numbers there, the chat room's there, and of course questions and answers are there. Video and audio of the show after the fact, it's all available at techguylabs.com, and it's free, and there's no sign-up, so that makes it easy. Candy is next from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Candy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey there, Leo.
Hello.
So glad to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
So I've been wanting to cut the cord.
Okay.
And I've been reading up on it. I have a house in town, and I also have a lake cabin, and spending a fortune on cable.
Mm-hmm.
So I ordered an HD antenna, which I have not received yet.
Okay.
And I'm leaning towards going with a Chrome stick. So I'm thinking, okay, I can pick up the regular station with my antenna and then watch Netflix through the Chrome stick, I guess.
Yes.
But there's some other stations that I want to be able to watch, and I don't know quite how to do that.
Right. And, of course, that's the big challenge of cord cutting, as you call it. Cord cutting, we should explain, cord cutting is basically saying sayonara to your cable company, saying, right, I'm going to do it all myself. The big challenge is naturally the live channels, the big events, the Academy Awards, the Super Bowl, stuff that you can only get on broadcast, basically, because almost everything else you can get over the internet. So you're doing the right thing, which is you get an HD antenna. Now, you need to figure out what you can see where you're going to live.
Right.
There's a site.
I don't know yet.
Yeah. So there's a site that you can do that ahead of time. There's two I mention regularly. One is the best is TVFool.com.
Okay.
And then the other one is was created by the National Association of Broadcasters and the Consumer Electronics Association. It's AntennaWeb.org. And in both cases, you'll enter in your new zip code, and it'll tell you where the antennas are, what you can reasonably hope to get from local stations. Because that's the key, really, to cord cutting. Because if you can get all three major networks, I should say all four if we include PBS, all five if we include the CW, if you can get all of those broadcast channels, man, then it's easy. The rest of it's easy, because you're exactly right. You know, your Netflix would be the number one thing. By the way, the Chromecast, which is what you're talking about, you call it a Chrome stick appropriately because it looks like a USB key that sticks into the HDMI port of your TV. And it is an internet streaming device. So anything that you could put on your phone, Android or iOS, that supports it, you can send to the Chromecast. Netflix is one, but Amazon and, there's a ton of stuff. They have a little Chromecast, even music services like Spotify, they'll have a little Chromecast button. You press it, it says, oh, I see you have a Chromecast on your living room TV. You say yes, and you can have it start playing. By the way, at that point, your phone is no longer streaming. The Chromecast says, I'll take it from here. It's the one getting your internet. Now, remember, you have to have good quality internet to make this viable.
I think I do.
Sometimes when you're moving to it's a cabin. It's a kind of more rural.
Well, the cabin doesn't have internet, yeah. So I'm thinking I might just be able to pick up a couple stations, which is fine.
Yeah, the internet is the trick. You got to have, I would say, reasonably 3 megabits down to watch a decent quality signal. 5 would be better, and of course, more is better. But you don't have to get a Chromecast. There's, in some ways, the Roku might be a little bit easier. There are great Roku choices. The current Roku 3 does everything you'd want. Apple TV, the only advantage Apple TV has is if you buy things from Apple, from iTunes, you can stream them on your Apple TV. Roku is good for everything except iTunes. Chromecast is an interesting kind of play on this. First of all, it's very cheap. It's $35 compared to $100 for a Roku and $250 for an Apple TV. So there's an advantage there. And it does pretty much everything you want, but you have to have the app on your smartphone. Turner Classic Movies, HBO Now. You can get every HBO show. If you want to watch Game of Thrones, you have to pay HBO, but you can get HBO shows that way.
So Chromecast is app-based.
Yes.
But Roku is not?
Roku is not. Roku basically makes your TV a smart TV. It adds internet capability to an existing TV. So it does all the work. You'll have a Roku remote. It displays everything on the screen. So it's a very conceptually very different. The Chromecast, the screen you're going to use at first to pick stuff, is your smartphone or tablet.
Okay.
And you're going to pick what you want to watch using the app from that service. And by the way, not all services support Chromecast, so you'll want to check to make sure that the Netflix does, but that the critical ones for you are Chromecast support. And that's one little issue. You can look at a Roku box and say, well, what do you support? And there's the list. Chromecast is a little more complicated because it requires the company that makes the app, generally the company that does the streaming, to build it in. So if I launch Netcast, I can pick a movie on Netcast, then press the Chromecast button, send it to my Chromecast, and then it takes over. You don't have an on-screen interface on the TV at all. Roku is the exact opposite. It's on the TV. You have a remote. You go through the various channels that you've added to your Roku. You pick Netflix. You browse on your TV. Often that's not as good an experience as the one on the tablet or the phone. You know, it's a little more limited. It's what we call the lean-back experience. But it's all built into your TV, so that, you know, that may make some people more comfortable.
So what about watching sports channels, like ESPN, for example? How would I get that?
So, you can buy it. ESPN, you would buy the Hulu. I'm sorry, the not Hulu. Begins with an S. Slingbox. Sling TV. And for, I think it's $20 a month, you get some Disney channels, you get ESPN, and stuff like that. ESPN is an interesting story. So that is the single most expensive channel for a cable company to carry. I think they pay like $6 a customer. Like Comcast, your cable company, pays ESPN $6 per customer. So it's an relatively expensive channel. On the other hand, they're also very, you know, they have devoted viewers who will not use a cable company if they don't have ESPN. So ESPN, there are a few networks in this enviable position, like HBO and ESPN, that can say, all right, we may really annoy our cable companies, but we're going to do it anyway. We're going to give it to you over the top. That means minus a cable company, just via the internet. But you still have to pay ESPN directly. And in this case, you're going to go to Sling, pay for the Sling TV, $20 a month, and you'll get ESPN. But, you know, there are limitations. I think game blackouts still apply. I'm not sure exactly how it works.
Oh, okay.
And remember, some NFL games are not on ESPN. For instance, they're on CBS. You'd only get that via your local.
The antenna,
right.
Hopefully.
Right.
And then what's the difference between Hulu and Sling?
Hulu is a, you can see how crazy this is because we're in a transitional period. Eventually, I think all our TV will come in over the internet and won't come through the air. But for the time being, it's a mixture of over the air, over the cable, and over the internet. And the problem is all these incumbents want, you know, are making demands of the content creators. So the content creators created their own company, Hulu. Originally, I think it was Fox and I can't remember who participated in this, and they've been fighting ever since over how it should be run. It's a pay service, but it's also a free service. The pay service still has ads. It's very confusing, but it's sometimes the only way you can watch, let's say, Desperate Housewives. I know, it's so confusing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Matthew from Austria. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Leo. I have a quick question.
Yes.
Actually. And first of all, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for listening. Where in Austria are you?
Vienna.
You know, there's a big competition to see who's going to become the next financial center of Europe, and it has been London. And everybody's thinking Vienna is going to be the next financial center. That might be the happening place.
Hopefully, we're head to head with Frankfurt now. So
yeah, it's head to head, it's neck and neck. Yeah, wouldn't you rather be in Vienna than Frankfurt? Come on.
Oh, absolutely.
Those happening Habsburgs, baby. It's where it's at.
That's true.
I was in Vienna last summer this time, and it is a beautiful city.
How'd you like it?
Loved it. Loved it. Really
great.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Will you be there in September during
No, we're not going back to Central Europe. We're going to be in the Baltic this time.
Oh, okay, terrific.
We like to mix it up. But I have to say, there's a soccer tort with my name on it somewhere there in Vienna. I'm just, I'm coming back.
Oh, definitely.
What can I do for you?
Well, I have an older HP laptop. It's an EliteBook 8440P.
Familiar with it.
Windows 7 was on it, yep. And I installed Windows 10 on it, and the first 2 months, it worked perfectly fine. Now, when I did the first the first update of Windows 10, whenever I start, I only see the boot screen, then it powers off automatically, and then I have to power it on again, and then everything works.
And then it works. Oy.
Yeah. It's kind of bugging me. I tried to set up already, and it's not really working.
So this only happens when you shut it down?
Exactly, or when I fully switch it on, when I get it out of the standby mode, it's fine. But when I actually power it on the first time, it powers down immediately. And the same thing is when I have to do a mandatory upgrade when Windows tells me.
Because you have to do a reboot. Upgrade. Yeah,
exactly.
This has been a problem on PCs for at least 30 years. I used to call it double clutching, where you have to kind of reboot after the reboot, and. It's my opinion it's a hardware flaw, not a software flaw. I can't promise you that, but here's why I think that. I feel like the first time it's cold. It's a cold start. And then it warms up a little bit, and it works better. And so sometimes that could, you know, it could just be the age of the EliteBook. It could be the hard drive is a little flaky, and it has to spin for a while before it kind of really kicks in.
Okay.
Could be a power supply. Could be a little flaky until it warms up. I presume this happens whether you're on power or on battery, right?
No. It actually happens when either or. So
yeah.
Whenever I'm...
Yeah. I mean, we've seen this for years. I can remember this happening for ages with a desktop PC where you turn it on. It would stop, or it would reboot spontaneously, and then it would work fine. And I it's my general feeling that it is usually a hardware. Now the issue. Now what'll happen if you call HP? Of course, it's out of warranty. But if you were to call HP, is they'd say, okay, well, first thing you got to do is wipe the drive and reinstall Windows. That's just to make sure it's not a software.
Oh dear.
Yeah, you don't want to do that, but that would assure it's not a software problem. Here's another way to do it, is to boot to a bootable disk instead. So download a Linux boot disk or any disk that'll have an operating system on it you can boot from. Doesn't have to be a CD or DVD, although I think you have an optical drive on that machine, right?
I do, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
But you could also do it with a USB key if it can boot from USB. The idea is, let's try it. Let's run an operating system, a different operating system, and see if the same thing happens. And if it does, that's the easy way of, without wiping your drive, assuring yourself it's a hardware problem, not a software problem. If you don't see that, if you boot into a Linux boot drive and everything works fine, then it is a software problem. And reinstalling Windows is probably the easiest way to fix it.
Okay, so I can't do anything with the BIOS, right? So I can't.
Let me think about that. I mean, you could. It's not necessarily could be a BIOS issue. Absolutely, and in a way, BIOS issues are like hardware issues. They don't have anything to do with Windows. It's something that happens before Windows. You might try first to see if there's a newer BIOS. And I think a machine of that vintage would have what they call ESCD, or Enhanced System Configuration Data, ESCD. There's often a setting in BIOS to reset that. You might try that as well. Make sure that, of course, your battery hasn't died, that you don't have trouble with keeping the date and time accurate, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think those are some things to try. This is a tough one to diagnose. I've seen this happen before, but I think those are some things to try. If it continues to happen with a boot operating system, not the one on your hard drive. There's something wrong. Could be a power. It could be a lot of things at that point. And it is an older laptop. That's not unusual, frankly.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have a Mac as well, and on the Mac, nothing happens. I mean, if I boot up, it boots automatically and everything. But the thing is, when you just told me, it's like this problem has been around for like 30 years. I was like, what?
Well, but that's why I don't think it's related to the operating system. That's why I think it's hard. It's okay. What happens when hardware gets a little flaky. Sometimes it needs to, believe it or not, this is not a technical description, it needs to warm up. And the double clutch warms it up a little bit.
Okay.
All right. And that usually means that something is failing or flaky. Could be, you know, sometimes it's literally something called a cold solder, where if the solder joint is cold, it's not making a proper connection. This is an improper solder. Now, modern computers aren't hand soldered by any stretch of the imagination, but in older machines, this would happen. If the machine was cold, the connection wouldn't be made. It couldn't start up. But as you attempted to start it up, it would warm up. The solder would melt slightly, make the electrical connection, then it would work fine as long as it was warm. I don't think that's what's happening to you, but that's an example of the kind of the category of issues that can happen with a cold machine. I think it, on an older computer, the first thing to go is the hard drive. And you know, this is a nice thing on that HP Elite. I think it's pretty easy to replace the hard drive. If it does seem to be a hardware problem, that'd be the next thing I would do, is replace the hard drive. Put an SSD in there, a solid state drive. You get a lot more performance. I'm so glad you're listening in Vienna. That's wonderful. We had a lovely time. What a beautiful old city. Beautiful old city. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. If you are in Vienna or India or any one of our international listeners, and you can see we have listeners all over the world, you can always use Skype to reach us. It won't cost you anything because it's a toll-free number in the U.S. 8888 Ask Leo. Somebody in the chat room saying a bad cap. That also could be it, a bad capacitor. And that notebook is of an era where there were bad capacitors in the supply chain. And maybe that's it. That's a little harder to fix. You can't exactly remove a capacitor from your motherboard and put a new one in. 8888 Ask Leo. Website techguylabs.com. More of your calls to come right after this. Mark is in Sandy, Oregon, our next caller. Hey, Mark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hey.
Hey, I love talking to the president. That's just great. Hey, I got a question, but first I wanted to plug my internet service provider.
Yes.
Well, I just got the bill, and it's $104.
Wow. A month?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
But this is the charges. The first charge is a water meter. That's $38.
Oh.
And then the sewer is $22. And then the storm water is $3. And we get about 60 inches of rain here.
Wow.
A year. So,
yeah.
Anyways, and then the Sandy Net is the fiber service. It's $39.95.
Oh, man. You're making me jealous. All that and sewer service, too.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. So, your ISP is your water company?
It's the city of Sandy.
See, now there are many people who think this is the right way to do things.
Well,
that it should be treated like a public utility, right? And now, the way I would love to see it, that would kind of be the best of both worlds, is if, as in your case, Sandy provides the wires, or in this case, fiber to your home, and then offers. Any company that wants to offer the service on top of that offers them the chance to do that. So that way you'd get competition, but the infrastructure, just like your water pipes and your sewer pipes and your electricity, is provided by the city. Do you have a choice of internet service providers on top of that fiber?
No, it
comes from Sandy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fine.
It's called SandyNet. You can look it up online.
That's fine, but you don't really have a choice, do you? You got it, SandyNet or nothing.
Well, no, we could. Verizon used to have service here.
Right.
They're really upset.
Yeah, I bet they are. And that's why
we could go with the cable company, that's Wave.
Right.
And they're a little irritated about it.
Yeah, I bet they are. And that's why this is politically difficult to do. Many municipalities would love to. In fact, it all started in the city of Philadelphia, Comcast's hometown. They offered municipal Wi-Fi, and Comcast immediately went to the state legislature and bought off some members of the legislature and got a law passed saying cities can't offer free internet access because it competes with local businesses. In this case, the political solution is for Sandy to offer the wire. I'd say this is a public utility, but then give companies like Verizon and Comcast and others a chance to compete on top of it. I'm glad it's worked, and kudos to your city council for having the cojones to pursue this route, because as you say, I'm sure it's annoying a few people.
Well, it all started about 10 years ago, and this kid at the junior high.
You're kidding.
He came up with an idea to do direct beam special Wi-Fi service, and he stuck it on some of the park structures around town.
Yeah.
And then the city decided, well, that'd be a good idea. So they started doing that all over town. And they had this it was a special Wi-Fi signal that worked. It worked pretty good. Like, it was getting around 10 megabytes up and down. But then they brought in a guy. His name is Joe Knapp, and that's a full-time situation
now. Now, what kind of speed do you get for that $40 a month?
We're getting it's running right about 99 up and down.
99 megabits both ways?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, puts the lie to the claim from all the commercial entities. Oh, no, we can't give you the internet of that speed at that price.
Well, there's a fiber cable that runs clear around the county. On the highway, and it's up on the phone lines.
Wow!
And it's a big circle that goes clear around the whole county, Clackamas County.
Right.
And they've tapped into that.
Amazing! Amazing.
But then the business class service is $20 more, and that's a gigabit.
That's a gigabit. That's amazing. Yeah. Can I move to Sandy?
Well, I got a house.
We're on our way. You know, by the way, this is how it stimulates the local economy. It's good for that business because now you, as a landlord, that house is much more desirable, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I got three houses here, and we're 30 minutes east of Portland.
From the big city.
Yeah, so, and we're halfway to the mountains, so I can be up skiing in 30 minutes.
That is a very desirable property because it's got low-cost, high-speed internet, among other things.
Right.
It helps to be 30 minutes from the city, too.
It changes everything in the city here. Yeah. I mean, people have been moving here like crazy.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, there are a lot of advocates for this kind of solution. I prefer kind of a more hybrid solution because I'd like to see more competition among the providers themselves on top of the infrastructure provided by the city. But
well,
I think this is definitely the way to do it.
They keep trying to sell us the DSL and the
cable. Oh, yeah. They're still there. They're not gone.
No.
But how are you going to compete against 100 megabits for $40?
Well, they don't.
They don't. And they won't be there much longer. And that's the real problem, because ultimately you won't have choice because the city's taken it over. And I think that's the legitimate argument against municipal internet, is that you want to make sure that there is some commercial incentive for other companies to be there as well.
Yeah.
Well, what can I do for you?
Well, I've been having a lot of troubles with my phone. I'm a truck driver, and when I plug the phone in, and I'll be listening to Twitter or something,
good man.
Or podcast, and I throw the phone up on the dash and plug it into the stereo in the truck. About the time I put it up on the dash, plug falls out and volume drops down, and I plug it back in. I just kind of repeat the cycle over and over and over. You can't hear the phone in the aux jack.
Right.
You can't hear it because it keeps dropping down to 75%. And it's just driving me nuts.
It's trying to protect your hearing.
Well,
so it thinks you're on headphones. It doesn't know from an aux jack to a headphone, right? Anything plugged into that headphone port.
To me, it's just dangerous because you got to pull the phone.
No, I understand.
Not
all phones have this, but many phones have a setting that says protect my hearing, make sure there's a limit when I've got headphones on, and you want to disable that if you can. Most Android phones will warn you They'll say, you know, it's bad for your hearing. Don't turn it up louder. But, of course, you're not listening on headphones. You're listening on an aux jack. You want it to be as loud as it can. But there's no way for it to know that whatever's plugged into that headphone port is not headphones. So this is kind of, they're trying to protect your hearing and, even more importantly, young people's hearing because they tend to turn it up too loud. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but I would check because with any luck, there will be a setting that says, don't do that. Just leave it the way it is. Don't protect my hearing. That would be the right thing to do. So check in your settings. If not, then I think you're kind of out of luck. I understand completely what you're saying. Completely understand that. We're going to take a break. Coming up, the GizWiz, Mad Magazine's maddest writer, Dick DiBartolo. Stay right here. Dickie D.
Leo, how are you, pal?
You got to talk to the powers that be at Mad Magazine and get them onto the Texture program there. You know about Texture?
No.
Oh, I love Texture. Texture allows, it's kind of like Netflix for magazines. You pay a flat fee.
Yes.
And you get like hundreds of different magazines and you get them on your iPad. But I don't think they have Mad Magazine.
I don't think they do.
Who owns Mad? Is it Condé Nast? Who owns Mad?
No, Time Warner.
Oh, that
DC Comics.
That explains it. They think it's a comic book. That's why. If you go to texture.com/tech guy, you can find out about it. They've got a free trial. Summertime is a great time to go to the beach, to take your iPad along with you or your iPhone, and you got to have a little beach reading. Texture gives you hundreds of the world's best magazines for one low price. You can even read them offline. Just download them, read them anytime, anywhere. Sports Illustrated, including the swimsuit edition, National Geographic, Wired, Esquire. I read New Yorker regularly on my Texture. You've got the subscription. You'll get every page of every issue on the newsstand today, plus back issues, plus features you don't get on print magazines like video, all that for one low rate. Everything from ABC Soaps in Depth to Architectural Digest and everything in between. Better Homes and Gardens, Bicycling, Billboard. You know, I probably would not subscribe to Billboard, but I love having it there so I can look at the charts, read about the music industry, Car and Driver, lots of cooking magazines. I love looking at recipes. Condé Nast Traveler, Consumer Reports, Cosmopolitan. Love taking the quizzes in Cosmo. Every month I'll take the sex quiz. Just because I can. Don't they do that in Cosmo? I thought they did. Maybe not. Dwell. I love looking at houses in Dwell. Anyway, go. I'm serious. And, I love this. You'll have access on up to 5 devices. So it's really a family plan. Lisa subscribes to Texture. I use her account on my iPad. Isn't that nice? Forbes and Fortune. Garden and Gun. There's a magazine called Garden and Gun. The perfect combination. Tulips and Glocks. Health magazine. Heed magazine. ID and Style. Just love. Look at all these magazines. Macworld, of course. So here's the deal. Right now, try it for free. Texture. TEXTURE.com/tech guy. I actually do read the National Review. I do, and I like reading that on a regular basis. I can't say I read the Oprah magazine. I'm sure, though, that Lisa does. That's the beauty part, because one subscription and we can see them all. Texture.com/tech guy. Lots to read, and it's all one low flat rate. This is Dickie D on his houseboat. You know who we saw? Dick D is here. Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer, and our gadget hound, and a disco freak. Do you still love the disco?
Yes, I do.
You know who we saw last night at the...
You don't see my disco lights in the back?
I do, actually. We saw at the Marin County Fair, they had the fireworks and Coolin' the Gang.
Oh, great.
Celebrate good times. It was fun.
Tonight.
I was dancing. I felt like it was in the 70s. They have the guitar and the whole thing. It was so much fun.
Well, you're a 70s kind of guy.
I am.
Yeah, you really are.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Dick joins us not to talk about disco or Mad Magazine, although both on both, he's an expert, but to talk, in fact, about gadgets, of which he's also quite good. What do you got
for
us?
So I was at a mid-year in the city. There are a lot of the CE Week and PepCom. And so I have never seen the Wi-Fi-enabled Samsung refrigerator.
Oh, no.
So they got together with MasterCard, and I'm walking down the aisle and I see this monster refrigerator with a 21.5-inch monitor built into the door.
That's pretty big.
It's big. And I said to the woman, I said, first of all, why do I see fruit and milk and things? Are you shopping? She said, no, that's what's in the refrigerator.
What?
I said, what? She said, yeah. She said, you're out shopping and you go, do I have eggs? Oh, let me look on my phone and look in my refrigerator. So it's very clever. Every time you close the door, it takes three pictures of the refrigerator because you might have taken something out or rearranged things. So from any smartphone, you can, if you're out shopping, see what's in the refrigerator. If the kids are always opening the refrigerator, you can just say, just look on the door and you can see what's in there. So, but why? And I said, well, why are you hooked up with MasterCard? So they've created an app called Groceries by MasterCard. And so far they've signed on Fresh Direct and ShopRite, where you can create your list, and it's not hooked up yet. You can't send it to the store yet, but you make up the list. As you shop, it brings up all the label information if you want to know calories and stuff. And then everybody can add to it, and then you can print it out, and everything gets billed to MasterCard. And I said, only MasterCard? No. She said, and any credit or debit card. We'd love you to use MasterCard, but of course it's open to anybody.
And it's just a matter of time before this actually goes direct to the store.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, it's very pricey because it starts at, I think she said it was about $4,500.
That's expensive.
Only because I then went to PC Richards and found a very similar refrigerator without all that, and that was about $2,000.
So you're paying $2,000. It's like a computer. You're buying an additional computer.
Exactly. It's 27 cubic feet, so it's big.
Yeah.
And something else I've never seen in a refrigerator because I just have a little one. There are four different units, compartments. One of the compartments, you select whether it's going to be a freezer or a refrigerator. So if you're having a party and you want tons of cold beers.
Oh, that's cool.
It's cool in more than one ways. It's either cool or cold.
And it also, it looks like it tells you how long stuff has been in the refrigerator.
Yes, it can peg.
Like how many months has that yogurt been there?
Yes, exactly. And how long it should have been there.
Yeah.
To still be
edible. Does it do that automatically? I guess it does because it's taking a picture, and so it knows.
Yeah, I think you have to hit the button to tell it to register that. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty neat, though.
If they tie this into my pantry, too, because I don't put everything in the fridge. Somehow I need the cupboards, the pantry, and the fridge to all do this, then I would be able to, or I could just go to write down a shopping list,
you could. You could say, Lisa, are we out of jelly?
We do this.
Isn't that easier?
No, we do this. Lisa says, she says, sit down at Google Keep, because that's what we use for our shopping list.
Oh, okay.
And start writing. And she'll just look around and say, okay, a dozen eggs. Okay, we need some cream. All right. And then I'll just take notes. And then we have a shopping list. And then we mail it to somebody and nothing happens. So that's the piece we got to work on.
I see. Okay.
Very cool. Very cool.
Interns.
Interns. We need more interns. The information is at the website gizwiz.biz. You got a great video of it at the CE Week event.
Yep.
I think very interesting. I mock this, but I'm starting to see as they make progress, more and more utility here.
Yes. As soon as the price comes down and they sell a ton of them, it's very clever. Yeah, it's very clever.
Samsung smart refrigerator. Dick DiBartolo, are you going to go out? Now, I know it's Monday is the 4th of July. They have the big fireworks in New York. It's a crowd. It's a zoo. It's a mess going over there. So now what you like to do or used to do is you'd go out in the river and then you'd look at the fireworks in between the skyscrapers On the other side. So you go on the Hudson, and then you watch the fireworks on the East River.
Because they're back in the East River again. Well, no, this year I'm going to... Macy's has an app now, the Make Light app. And it blinks your... It colors your phone to sync with the fireworks.
So you never have to leave home at all.
No, I'm going to have my 4K TV, the Make Light app, and stay home.
Have a wonderful 4th. Enjoy Independence Day. I know it's fun in New York City. A lot of fun.
I'm sure you're going to have a blast doing it.
All right, Dickie D. Go to gizwiz.biz. That's his website for more information about his great gadgets. And, of course, don't forget the GizWiz podcast he does every week featuring this and many, many more gadgets at gizwiz.tv. Last call of the day is from Fullerton, California. And Diego's on the line. Hi, Diego.
Hi, Leo. Good
Welcome.
To talk to you.
Good to talk to you. What can I do for you?
We have a new construction build happening currently in Fullerton, as you said. And one of the rooms we're dedicating into a movie room. And wanted to get some advice as to what kind of speaker system, what kind
of... Oh, man.
Purchase.
I only have 2 minutes. This is fun. Do you have a budget?
For the media room, I mean, honestly, say $15,000.
You're going to have a blast. You're going to have a blast. So you obviously want to get a big screen TV. And remember, the one calculation you have to make is based on the size of the screen is based on your distance from the screen. And you need it to be bigger than you think in general. How far back will the most important people be sitting?
The room itself is 25 by 20.
Right. So if you're 20 feet back, you need a big screen. But most people are going to be, 10 feet away?
I'm thinking about just putting, two rows of, like theater-type seating.
So one of the decisions you're going to have to make is between direct view, like LCD or OLED display, where it's coming from the TV versus projection. The advantage of projection is it can be big. You can get a 100-inch screen easily, just but the projector's behind you. And if you're making a media room, that's a lot more doable. Putting a projection TV in a living room is tough because people walk in front of it and stuff, but you're going to have a screening room. So I would definitely investigate projection. Now, remember, projectors can cost a lot of money. You go to Runco, you're spending your entire budget and then some on a projector. But there are plenty of good projectors in the $2,000 to $3,000 or $4,000 range. Epson is my favorite. Disclaimer, they advertise their printers on our show, but they make excellent. The cinema projectors are fantastic. And then you're going to want to get a nice surround sound system. And if you listen to Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru, he's going to say get a Dolby Atmos compatible system. I can go on, but you know what? Maybe I should point you to the AVS Forum. That's Scott's publication, avsforum.com. Has lots of information on this. And we'll put some more comments in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Anybody got an opinion, let us know. Thanks for the call. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next time. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Bye-bye. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. And on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.